CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramoni's present.
So it's a special show.
It is a special show and a special day for South Africa because it's about 3 weeks before the apocalypse, before the point that destitute come up and rise.
Yes, 17 million people, a mob of 17 million people.
Right, because that's what we think about poor people who don't receive
Well, if I didn't get my salary for the month, I would also be like, seriously, well, I might turn to violence.
I would write an open letter first.
Yeah, of course, that's what you do.
And then phone Reedy.
Yeah.
And then I may write a more strongly worded letter.
Yes, yes. And then you would wait for these sort of opinionistas in society to release their Mail and Guardian and Daily Maverick columns, which would make you feel better.
And then I'll wait for the joint sitting of Parliament where Musi can come up and says, I speak on behalf of the 4 million unemployed people, including Ramon Kavanek. And the housing has broken my bank balance. And then, yes, then we'll carry on. But nevertheless, yes, so the revolution is coming, apparently on April the 1st, which is not ironic at all in our country. So we just make the most of it while we're here.
Yeah, and we've made the most of it for a year. That's why it's a special sort of show. We've been around for a year now. Started off as a six-week pilot, sort of, let's see if this works out, if there's any interest. And now the top show on Cliff Central and one of the top podcasts in the country.
In terms of quality or just downloads?
Well, of course, we know it's always in terms of quality. And, well, download numbers, we just wait for Prime Media to troll us. And we know our download numbers are high. So.
No, indeed. I mean, I think it's been quite a good year. We've spoken to a lot more important people than I expected, to be honest. I think 25% of all our guests have PhDs. I did a little calculation the other day. I mean, it's not bad for like two racist, misogynist white guys from the burbs of Joburg.
Yeah, you left out privileged. You left out privileged.
I thought it was obvious in the burbs of Joburg. Nevertheless, not too bad going, I must be honest. I'm as surprised as everyone else that it's going so well.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised at all. I completely thought that this would happen. So what are we going to do today, other than talking about the imminent collapse of the social welfare system, which in some ways could be fantastic?
I agree.
I mean, it's not. It won't be fantastic to have poor people not getting what they have become accustomed to, in essence, and need to live. Because, you know, if every month they've been getting a stipend, because that's what it is, it's not a lot of money.
No.
If they've been getting a certain amount of money, and that's literally how they buy their food, suddenly in April not getting that is not a good thing at all. But in the greater scheme of things, if we could somehow dissolve the welfare state, that'd be great.
I don't care too much about the welfare state. I just want to dissolve the state.
Yes, we know.
In total, this could be the first part of it. But nevertheless, so yes, back to our podcast, Jonathan.
Yes, our podcast. Well, it's obviously interesting stuff going on, which we'll talk about as we go through the show. We're going to reflect on some of the stuff we've done in the past year. And lots of great shows. Of course, as a listener to this show, you know that it's compulsory to download everything all the way back. So you've done that already. But if you haven't yet listened to some of the shows, we might remind you of the ones you haven't yet listened to and of some of the ones you listened to and really enjoyed and maybe you want to give a second listen to. We've discussed lots of stuff. We've had some guests on discussing. We've discussed drugs. We've discussed the free market quite a lot. We discussed libertarianism.
We discussed the media in general. We discussed scenario planning.
Yeah, we've done a fortune. I mean, the media, as an example, it's been an interesting year for the media. We had the rise and fall of the Daily Pox.
Yeah, the fall. Huffington Post hasn't risen yet, so they can't fall.
A lot of money spent on advertising.
I mean, they can't fall much further from where they are now, so it's almost a non-entity.
It's hard to rise when you have an anchor like Virashni pulling you to the ocean floor. But there's been a lot of interesting developments and changes, and we had Gus Silber on the show.
Indeed. We're going to play a little excerpt soon. But for the media last year, I think it was quite a bruising year. Maybe not so much in South Africa specifically, but especially in Europe and in the States, with Brexit and Trump happening in the same year, and the media were completely against the results in both.
Yeah.
And
it became quite obvious that they followed a certain narrative that which they expected to run in a certain way.
Right. For the coastal elites mostly. But I saw a statistic that Trump's approval rating is about 45%, which is very low for a new president.
Yeah.
The media rating is about 15%.
Yeah. So, and there's studies between 9 and 11% of how many. I know it's an American study, but between 9 and 11% of Americans actually trust their media. So, obviously you want a free press, but you'd also like that free press to be doing stuff.
Well, we don't have a free press here in America. It's a corporate press. There's corporate interest all the way through. Other than Alex Jones, right, and a few smaller papers, all the big guys are owned by corporations.
Yeah, and Alex Jones is insane.
Yeah, well, the interdimensional alien beings that will suck out your brain, and the fluoride's making the frogs gay, Alex Jones.
It's unbelievable that even without fluoride, he just pulls off his shirt at any opportunity. You know, it's amazing what he would do with fluoride.
But, I mean, back to media, I mean, I think it's important to say, people say, yeah, we have a free press. We don't. We have a corporate press. Naspers owns how many papers? And that other independent media group.
Independent.
Yeah.
Owned by Survey.
Yeah, Survey. What's his name?
Iqbal Survey. Dr. Iqbal Survey, excuse
me. That's a great villain name, I must be honest. The next James Bond, he should be the villain. But we don't have a free press. Arguably, this Cliff Central, this podcast, the blogs are far more free than the media. I mean, I worked in a commercial radio station for a few weeks back, and I wasn't allowed to say much at all.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's exactly why consumption is quite important. So let's just listen to what Gus has to say about this.
Well, look, I think we're very lucky. I think we've got a vigorously free press. It really is vigorous. Absolutely. And it's a fighting press as well. It fights to make its opinions heard. It fights against government interference. It's one of the great things about South Africa is its free press. I think people who don't broaden their horizons and who don't consume multiple media are actually letting themselves down. So if you want to just read one paper a day or listen to one radio station, that's entirely your right. But if you are doing it, you're missing out on a multiplicity of opinions, some of which will drive you crazy and some of which will make you very angry. But I think it's your duty as a citizen of this constitutional democracy to massively be a promiscuous consumer of media. Otherwise, you're letting yourself down.
Yeah, so Gus there espousing on why you should be promiscuous in your consumption of media. And it goes back to what you're saying, which is if you really just follow one sort of what you would call corporate media.
Well, even one narrative, right? I mean, the Sunday Times, City Press, and all them are so-called rivals, but they can all push one narrative towards you. So it's important to read, Dan Roots. He has an online newspaper.
Yeah.
Maybe not that.
Yeah.
But independent work is quite important too.
Yeah, you could put like that paper in with like the Daily Vox and just say, look, I don't read things that are like fringe and like crazy on either side.
I read the Daily Vox. Daily Fox. Sorry. With the Freudian slip there. But nevertheless, so read as much as possible and sneer at it all, actually, to be honest with you. Nevertheless, so, I mean, our first show, I think let's start right at the beginning. We were the first people ever, other than our guest, Michael Cardo, who's a DAMP. We were the first to publicly state that Rhodes must fall are a bunch of fascist thugs.
Yeah, and that this would all end very, very badly. Long before it all ended very, very badly.
For them.
Yeah, and also for our universities. I mean, the truth be told is that UCT is not particularly in a good place right now. In terms of other measures, they've fallen in rankings and things. Some people say that's got nothing to do with Rhodes Must Fall, and maybe it doesn't. But certainly it'll be interesting to see what develops there over the next few years. There's a lot of nervous tension with regards to what's going to happen this year on campuses, including UCT. across the country. We were the first to kind of call it out because Mike called it out. I mean, he was
He came on the show because he wrote an article in Politics Web about the fascist underpinnings of Rhodes' fall at the time, and which is all borne out by this postmodernist sociology that's being perpetually taught, you know, in sociology and whatever, in BA studies at UCT as well, I'm afraid to say. So, I mean, a good podcast to listen to, which we did, of course, was with the legendary Gad Father himself, Gad Saad.
Yeah, the Gad Saad show was great. There were a number of topics discussed, but he made some really interesting points around relevance in terms of a lot of the stuff you see getting published now. You know, there's an interesting account to follow. I'm not sure if you follow it. Is Real Peer Review
I follow that one. Very
Real
well.
Peer Review on Twitter. Real Peer Review essentially picks up gender studies papers and these sort of diversity studies papers and all these sort of arts type of degrees that have been invented in the last decade. And it picks up a lot of this stuff, and it's amazing what you can get a PhD for, you know, writing your opinion of how Beauty and the Beast is a patriarchal, misogynistic perpetuation story, and that kind of thing. That gets you a PhD, and they make fun of that, and in a way that's kind of disturbing because people are actually getting very much higher degrees out of doing this kind of stuff. So Gad summarizes quite nicely the differences between where the sciences sit from an academic perspective and where the social sciences sit.
If you start off with the premise that there are no innate biological differences between the sexes, other short of their genitalia, and everything else is socially constructed, is due to socialization.
Mm.
Well, that is a profoundly, demonstrably false position. I mean, biologists defined humans as being a sexually dimorphic species. I mean, that's the way we're defined as a species, right?
Indeed.
So if you start with that premise as your starting point, and then you're now going to build in your tree of knowledge, you're going to start with that root node and build from there, then anything that starts after bullshit is bullshit, right? And so that's the problem with these fields, is that they're not – and actually, I'm writing right now. I'm just revising a paper for one of the leading journals in my field, where I actually talk about these trees of knowledge. And I basically refer to the notion that what makes physics, chemistry, and biology prestigious, or more so than sociology and some of the other fields, is not that because physicists are inherently smarter or more sophisticated than sociologists. It's because they operate, and I actually made this point in my first book, it's because they operate within trees of knowledge that are consilient. And consilient is a beautiful term that very few people sort of know what it means, and it was reintroduced into the common lexicon by E.O. Wilson, the famous Harvard biologist. It refers to unity of knowledge. So when you talk about consilience, you could say that physics is more consilient as a discipline than sociology.
Yeah.
Precisely because, you know, chemists are not debating whether some believe in the periodic table and others are anti-periodic table, right?
Yeah.
But in the social sciences, the starting point could already send you to completely different parallel universes.
Mm.
That's the problem with the social sciences and certainly the humanities.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point made by Gad. Once again, a great podcast to listen to. We know we've got the sort of intellectual space that has been completely infiltrated by this cultural Marxism. It's an issue over decades, and it's resulted in problems not only in South Africa, but we've seen obviously across the world. America is a good example. Their campuses are on fire. Even recently, we've got, what was it, about a month ago, those Berkeley protests. That was over Milo.
Yeah, and someone actually got shot, and they set fire to something or other.
Yeah, and then just this past weekend, there was a counter sort of rally for Trump, which I don't know what they were expecting the outcome of that to be, but there was a counter rally for Trump, and there was violence that broke out between both sides. I saw some old man got pepper sprayed for wearing a Trump hat, apparently, but then there was also some idiot from the pro sort of Trump side with like a stick trying to hit people. It was like, well, retarded and also stupid because it's violence.
Yeah, I mean, but this is perpetuated by the teaching of these ideologies on campus, and I think it will carry on. I think they took a massive blow last year with the rise of Trump and the alt-right. Though the alt-right really are a reaction to the wacky left in a way. I don't see.
Yeah, it's that horseshoe that Gareth described on the show we did with him.
Right. And I don't see vindication in any of those groups for myself, at least. I think they sort of deserve each other in a way. One makes memes, the other one hits people with sticks. Like, it's great. It's a marriage made in heaven for the massive, massive extreme center, which happens to be like 60-70% of people in the world. Or in America, at least, or even in South Africa, I would argue.
Yeah, I think. Well, we've said it so many times before. People just want to get on with things. It's even why we battle sometimes to add listeners to this show, because as interesting as we are, of course, and as much as people tune in for Ramon's sexy voice, he's nodding along. They are like, no, I just want to, like, I don't know, tune in to like some DJ playing some random tunes and just drive along in my car. So people generally just want to get on with things, and they aren't particularly extreme in their views in any which way. We showed that quite well when we looked at all the studies that have been done. You know, the race war of 2016 that we had to debunk.
Oh, but that was debunked beautifully.
Well, there's been developments, of course.
The ANC war room.
Yes.
50 million raid paid to Shaka et al. And his ilk for spreading, I don't know, what were they spreading? Fake news, apparently. And it blew up all their faces. And the hashtag, where is Shaka, must come back, because he's just disappeared. He used to have a TV show. He was active on Twitter. And now he's just gone into the ether.
He's reinventing himself as an ANC member in the Northwest province so that he can also join Parliament. You know, because that's what you do. You just, once you disgrace yourself, you go away for a while, and then you come back as a member of parliament with potentially a portfolio in government coming up.
Oh no, I would think he would join. He would come back within about a year after Zuma loses. Zuma will be out of the ANC presidency in 2017.
Yeah, just controlling it from a back room somewhere.
So maybe Shaka will come out in 2018. I always was against Zuma. Now the real ANC is coming back, and now I can come join. Yeah. I was always against him, against Zuma, of course. He paid me a few million to
spread. I think
spread
that's going
to
be a narrative that they pick up, actually.
Well, it's the very same thing where the woke Twitter likes to say that no white people supported apartheid, which is true in a way and quite funny, because after apartheid, everyone's like, oh, I always was against it. Whereas that's not true. Some were for it.
Well, that's very obvious. Some white people did support apartheid. Yeah, I mean, we had Steve Hoffmeyer on, and he made it quite clear that some of the things he quite bought into. So there's a person who, in some respects, supported
it. Right, but that same thing will happen in whenever, 2019, or whenever Zim is actually out, if ever he's out. And then you'll get these same people coming in. I was always against Zuma. Now the real ANC is coming back. We got the proper people back in place. It was just a blip on the radar.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Yeah. This is the real, it'll be the real ANC.
Yeah, of course. No.
Like New Coke.
The ANC of Tambo and Sisulu and all these other dead people, they wind up, you know, every time they talk about the ANC. They never talk about the newer people in the ANC, you know, the ANC of Zuma. No one ever says that.
Well, they do currently say it. They criticize it. You know, you've got morons like Batabile Dlamini running around.
Please, we do not mock people with a disability. Alcoholism is extremely...
I think moron is an actual medical term.
Alcoholism is very destructive to brain cells, Jonathan Witt.
Okay, I can't disagree with that. It is destructive to brain cells.
She should be seen as a patient, not as the criminal...
You think we've got a full sort of DSM-5 in our government? It's just like, you know, from the alcoholics to the sort of paranoid schizophrenics, because they also seem to think that everyone's out to get them. I mean, you know, white monopoly capital is coming.
Yeah, which is being perpetuated by a PR firm in London.
Yeah.
Who's being paid 24 million rand by the Guptas to spread news and information.
Are they still paying that firm, or I thought they bailed?
Bell Pottinger, as far as I'm aware. to spread white anomaly capital, you know, the narrative around. And you got the Jimmy Manyes, you can't call him Jimmy anymore. What's his name? Zwanele.
Zwanele.
Zwanele Manji. Anyway.
Call him Jimmy because it irritates him, I'm sure. And,
yeah.
And that's cool.
But talk about politics. Oh, something happened. Talk about politics. I mean, last year, people keep moaning about the left and the right and things like that. Or we prefer the conservatives and the liberals because it's actually data to support what each means. I mean, we had the great Jordan Peterson on.
Yeah, so the Jordan Peterson podcast was superb, if I say so myself. And it wasn't really us, it was him.
Because we let him speak, right? Because we had him before.
So we didn't do what Sam Harris did. So there are de facto better than Sam.
Oh, by far. I'm way better than Sam in many, many ways. But what he did, he managed to show, using psychological evidence of Jonathan Haidt's work at least, the difference between liberals and conservatives, especially the concept of borders.
Yeah, let's give that a listen.
So liberal people tend to be high in a trait called openness, which is a creativity dimension, but low in a trait called conscientiousness, which is basically industriousness and orderliness. Particularly, it's the orderliness part of conscientiousness that's the best predictor. Whereas conservatives tend to be high in conscientiousness, particularly orderliness, and low in openness. And that divide isn't going away. It's built into the human landscape. And partly what politics does, and this is really new understanding, I would say, and it's really only become clear in the last, to the degree it is even clear, in the last 15 years, partly because of the work of people like Jonathan Haidt, who's been investigating the biological underpinnings of political and moral belief. And we've done a fair bit of work in that regard in my lab as well. So you can't just make half the population's take on the world illegal. That isn't going to work. And here's something to think about. I think this is very important. So I mentioned that the primary political axis seems to be openness and conscientiousness, and those traits aren't very highly correlated. They vary independently. And so if you're high in one, that does not predict you being high in the other. In fact, quite the opposite in the case of those two. So the question is, why in the world does the political spectrum run along the axis of creativity and orderliness, essentially? And I figured it out, I think. And it's really something to know. I believe that the primary political question, and perhaps it's always been this question, is borders. And the liberals and the left, say, lean towards open border policies, and the conservatives lean toward closed border policies. But it's not just political borders. That's the thing. It's the idea of borders per se. And so, you know, there are things in different categories have borders between them. People's identities have borders between them. Concepts have borders between them. And the conservatives like to have the categories tightly encapsulated and fortified and separate. Because orderly people, for example, are disgust sensitive. It's part of what grounds their orderliness. It's really useful to know. So, for example, my reading has been that Hitler was incredibly disgust sensitive. And that's actually why he embarked on this racial cleansing program. I mean, he was obsessed with hygiene, and he modeled the Aryan race as a body that was under attack by pathogens. And that's grounded in disgust, not fear. It's a completely different thing. And it's really new idea, you know, and that, again, partly that stems out of Jonathan Haidt's work. But anyways, so the liberals want open borders. They want information and goods and people to flow freely between categories. They like to mess with categories because they're creative, and because they're not high in orderliness, they don't care about the mess that causes. Whereas conservatives, they're worried about information flow and the flow of goods and the flow of people. And it's partly because their concerns about hygiene and purity are elevated. And the problem with all this is, like, there's no right answer, eh?
Yeah. So that and many other sort of pearls that were extruded on that podcast.
Yeah, and I think he was the defining liberal in the classical sense of 2016. He saw a problem about words or the use of words, and he managed to condense history, psychology, philosophy, religion into explaining why he's against this. It's not just a case of the word themselves, it's about what it means to be forced to say words, or what it means to enforce lying.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Although, unfortunately, he seems to be losing the battle. So I think he's winning the battle in the sense that he's garnered quite a large following. And once again, that middle we speak of are fully behind him, I think, those who are invested in what's going on politically. But it seems as if a lot of the stuff is still going through the parliament or their sort of legislatures.
Yeah, it's going through. These things don't... I mean, unless it's mass demonstrations, most people don't actually care. Most people don't care that there are 72 genders. Most people don't care that someone would prefer to call...
Well, there aren't 72 genders.
No, whatever.
Just put that out there.
Right. There's
two.
Three. Intersex is a gender, isn't it?
Yeah, all right. Okay. Yeah. I'll let it slide.
Grant me that. Most people don't care, right? Because they don't know any transgender people, which is not surprising, because they are 0.003% or whatever it is of the population. Mm. So,
and they usually want to be left alone.
Right. Well, most people, yes. So Jordan picks on the idea at hand, and for him it's extremely important, and for us it's sort of important too, especially when you actually listen to what he says. But for ordinary people, and we keep using the term ordinary as if that means anything, which it doesn't. No one's really ordinary. You either...
Normal people.
There's only 2,000 people, us and wankers, right? So... But nevertheless, the ordinary working person doesn't give a shit about that.
Yeah, and it's just this. I think the concept. I think it becomes very worrying when the government starts to police words, and we've discussed the dangers of this sort of authoritarian rule. And once again, it's that horseshoe, because you've got the left going, no, you must be made to say zur as a pronoun, and the right wanting to, if you look at sort of things that have been pointed to about Donald Trump being authoritarian, the left goes nuts about the one but not about the other, the right goes nuts about the one but not about the other, and
it's almost like people don't have principles anymore. Jonathan, what is this nonsense?
Yeah.
No principles.
So that's been a big thing for me, I think, in the last year and in doing the show. I always say I learn a lot from our guests. I've learned a lot through this process.
So do I, yeah.
And I've managed to solidify a lot of my feelings and thoughts on things, but also change things. You know, that whole concept of presented with a better argument. Certainly, for example, on the drug war thing, I am far further now in terms of where I stand in feeling with regards to legalization, with regards to decriminalization, than I was a year ago, and certainly than I was 5 or 10 years ago.
Sure.
And I think that's very, very important that people are able to do that. And I hope that, you know, listeners to this show have listened to some of the stuff and gone, sure, that's an interesting perspective. That's an interesting view. We had Ian Benson on, you know, and he was touting for...
Yeah, for those who don't know, he's a Catholic legal scholar.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the virtues of using virtues of metaphysical virtues of philosophy and religion to try to understand what words mean, especially in the legal sense.
And also the virtue of religion and the sort of foundation and structure that it's given society.
Right.
And he did give quite a compelling argument, and even towards the end of the show it wasn't meant to be discussed, but an interesting differing view on the abortion debate.
Right.
And I think that, you know, he didn't change my stance necessarily on that, but he made me a lot more thoughtful with regards to that whole discussion.
Right. I mean, I think, personally speaking, Jordan Peterson and someone like Professor Ian Benson, they've actually made it a bit, not cool, but it's more acceptable to talk about religion now in a way that we haven't before. It always used to be a bit binary. So you had the new atheists, where religion was everything terrible and you're stupid for believing it.
Mm.
And even they suffered in their stance. If you look at Sam Harris when he talks about Islam, he's not as... He doesn't, you know, sweep everyone in one with one paintbrush, so to speak. He is quite much more nuanced now than he used to be. Dawkins, I think, is a bit of a... Well, he's past his prime, really.
I still quite like Dawkins. I think though that it, like anyone, you know, it's. I can see similarities between someone like Milo Yiannopoulos and Richard Dawkins. And I'm not saying in terms of intellect, because I think Richard Dawkins is a genius, but in terms of those people who say the most sort of far out things on a specific topic,
right,
to push a reaction.
Yeah.
And make you pick a side. And look, if you're sort of a Dawkian, or whatever they're called, and you know, when he had Hunter Martz on, Hunter sort of says that people worship at the altar of people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, etc. And he's probably correct, because what they're doing is, if you love Richard Dawkins and he says something and it's outrageous, and you love him, you'll buy it. You'll buy straight into that almost radical version of what he's proposing. And whereas if you hate him, you'll be completely put off by it. I mean, Milo, you know, has been doing that all. I think he's done now, but that was his whole thing. And he even said he's a provocateur. You know, he's yes. trying to just provoke reaction.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it seems like the Republicans actually took him down rather than the left. I mean, how useless are the left in taking someone like Milo Yiannopoulos down in this regard? Yeah, but you need people
They try to take him down. They try to take him down with the wrong way. They try to take him down with violence. They try to take him down with no deplatforming him.
Yeah.
Instead of taking him down by challenging bad ideas, so. And we can argue quite a lot about what took him down. And, you know, he was on a show. We've said it before. He was on a show where he mentions stuff about pedophilia, essentially. I mean,
pederasty.
Pederasty. Basically, older men having relationships with boys, with young boys. And
yeah.
he did defend it. I can't defend what he said on that show. I disagree with it. But it's interesting, that's what took him down, is he had a bad idea, and they took his bad idea and said, these are your beliefs or your ideas.
Then they strawmanned the shit out of him.
Right? Okay, so they did strawman. That was another great show, actually, was the show we did with philosopher
Jason Werbeloff.
Jason Werbeloff, that's it. And we spoke about steel manning. We spoke about philosophical concepts.
Well, we spoke about the use of logic in everyday yeah. debates, right? So it's about trying to be as charitable as possible with your opponent's arguments. And also, yeah, well, that's what steel manning is in a way. And I don't know if we've done that, if I'm honest. I think we're getting better.
It's a difficult thing to do. I think it takes a lot of thought. I think the people who are the most, even the people who are most considered in their dialogue and their discussion, you know, that Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson podcast, where they could not come to sort of an agreement on stuff, was a great example of someone like Sam Harris, who I think to be a very considered thinker. Certainly, you know, when you listen to him speak, it's almost as if every word is edited as it's coming out of his mouth or out of his brain.
Yes.
And even he was unable to steel man his opponent. He was unable to be charitable and generous about what Jordan was saying.
Yeah, well, I think Sam Harris has a serious ego issue on this. He's incapable of being wrong.
Mm.
Or being perceived as wrong. So he will stretch out an argument for as long as possible to a degree where it's not even fun for the audience. For example, for that one, they were talking about the concept of truth. And yeah. they had different opinions on what the concept of truth is. And Sam Harris was absolutely stunned that a religious guy like Jordan Peterson has a different conception of truth than an atheist like Sam.
Himself, yeah.
Right. And instead of just saying, okay, Jordan, I'll just call my truth fact, and you can call your truth a higher truth, and cool, let's get on. He refused to do that. He just kept banging on about what truth is for 2 hours. And it absolutely failed as a podcast. So, yeah, even apparently great intellectuals like Sam Harris failed to do it. Not that I think I'm Sam Harris. I'm more intelligent. Because I do things, feelings matter a lot more than we think. Rationalism doesn't answer everything.
You think? Yeah, so you're not a big fan of rationalism.
Well, I don't know if it exists as a concept. What does it mean?
Because everyone is different in what they would view as rational.
Well, no. I mean, if you look at the work of Jonathan Haidt, as he says
we're not rational beings.
Well, rationalism never existed, ever. It was a flawed economic model. It was a homo economicus, the rational human, right? So the more freedom we have, we'll use the resources for our rational selfishness. And if you look at the research, it shows that we are far more intuitive than rational. We have a gut feeling about something, and then we try to justify it. And that is borne out through genetics and our environment growing up. So people can be born liberals, of course, but growing up in an environment of liberals will make you a liberal. You're not going to become a conservative. You have to actually work hard to be a conservative. So people hold very irrational positions all the time, and we may do as well. So, yeah, I don't think rationalism is actually a thing.
Yeah, I don't fully agree with Haidt on that particular point, because I think that there's a middle where there are some things that are intuitive, and they're sort of base instinct almost. And it doesn't matter what you feed into the system. Your decision is first informed by, as he says, you know, this intuition. Now, I think there are in some areas where you may be informed by being rational. So if you know nothing about a certain thing and it's not a particularly life or death type of scenario or decision making process, you may be rational about your input to that. And I also think that rationality can sort of come and go on certain topics. So I think that right now, if you held an election in America, people would not vote rationally at all. I think if the same election, you know, when Bill Clinton was elected or perhaps in 20 years' time when they've gone over electing celebrities to be their president, people aren't just like, I'm a liberal, so I'm voting Democrat, or I'm a Republican, so, you know, I'm voting, you know, I'm a conservative, I'm voting Republican. When there's less driving forces to be intuitive, then you're able to accept some outside data and information instead of just immediately going to that gut feel.
Well, I mean, if rationality existed, we wouldn't be voters.
Yes, here we are, back to this.
No. If you take voting on its own accord as a single voter, it's irrational to vote. Because it doesn't mean...
Yeah.
Statistically, it means nothing. And that's about it. So why do people still vote? It doesn't mean anything, statistically.
Yes, as a single... Well, Jason actually discussed this on his show. As a single voter, doesn't mean anything. But, you know, as a voter myself, I... And know that my
and you call yourself rational.
I know that alone it means nothing, but I also know that there's going to be a fair percentage of people going and casting their votes, and together it does mean something. So
if the delusion is shared, it's far better.
Sure.
Then it's not under any illusion whatsoever.
Sure, it's not necessarily a delusion if you're all doing it and all following a system. This is the whole thing about the system.
Says one is anti-religious. That's a shared delusion based on your account. Some delusions are worthy of pursuing, not others.
Well, I go to vote. I cast a vote. They count actual votes. They tell me how many were voted for one guy and how many voted for another guy, and then they make one guy in charge. So, yes, it's something that I can see.
How they're working out for you.
In South Africa, it's a bit of a middle road at the moment. Interestingly, we had that last year. We had a couple of shows discussing what would happen with elections.
Right. That election was also a black swan, to be honest. I mean, we were actually quite surprised that they managed to win all the metropolitan areas, the DA specifically.
Yeah, all the ones that they sort of had a chance of getting, they got. Even though Joburg is a coalition, very much a coalition.
Also, so Pretoria.
Yeah, although Pretoria's close.
Yeah, well, whichever. It doesn't really matter. So that was another black swan moment. I mean, we had, I can't remember, I think a third or fourth show, we had Franz Kronier. of the Institute of Race Relations. And what's interesting about him, he's a scenario planner, not a forecaster. And in the show,
he's quite specific about what the difference
is. And he does state what the difference is. But I just spliced a little clip from where he says what his personal, well, maybe not his personal, but what the prediction of the IRR is.
Yeah. So let's listen to that.
Yeah. So I think that's their likelihood. They're not going to meet popular expectations. I think they're going to essentially lose an election within the next decade. And I think that's going to give rise to a very peculiar series of bedfellows in a coalition government. That's the 75% likelihood as we sit here today. 25% likelihood is that the reformist wing of the party coming out of its hardline left, not the right, they'll win the support of the right later, is going to pull off a remarkable turnaround, and South Africa is going to be a 5% growth economy with rapidly falling unemployment by the end of the decade. The mistake you make is to write off the minority scenario because it sounds too incredulous, and you miss significant opportunities for South Africa if you do that. Although on current trends, The more rocky road scenario beckons, unfortunately. Yeah, but here there, wax warning on why current trends are so dangerous. Because when they break, fundamentally, countries move into different paradigms. And just try and put yourself in the position of the ANC, NEC at the moment. What must a meeting be like? You can't fill a stadium. Even the Democratic Alliance is trying to fill stadiums. I mean, when did sort of liberal sort of society start filling stadiums? I mean, how have you lost control of the country? The EFF packs out stadiums. You don't have the money to implement your grandiose socialist schemes of national health insurance and free education and building new universities and all sorts of other things. The comrades who are looting the fiscus don't actually have the CapEx projects anymore to do that with. Your opinion polls have turned against you. It's my great friend Darby Ruart has a wonderful quote about Hemingway, who writes about the man who goes bankrupt. And people say to him, how did that happen? And the man says, well, first slowly and then very fast. And political parties lose control in the same way. And the ANC is now in the very fast. The great story is about senior ANC leaders arriving to go on the campaign trail, and the police say to them, if you go into this neighborhood, we suggest you campaign from inside the Inyala, because we think the people will tear you to pieces if you walk in the streets.
Right, so, I mean, we'll see whether his forecast comes true. It'll be interesting to see if someone who's like hardcore left in the ANC comes out as hardcore right. On economic principles.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like it at all. You've been a big proponent of the worst thing to happen to us is Pravin. I'm not in complete disagreement, although I don't think that the problem is that people are protecting Pravin Gordhan to try and stop the alternative. So I think if we just had a normal, that's a very odd term.
If we had not a normal democracy,
I was going to say normal functioning government, but if we just had a government whereby we looked at the people and we said, all right, is this guy doing a good job? No, yes, whatever. Then most people, I think, would say Pravin has done quite a terrible job, in fact. He's in the last sort of 8 years, I think it is, he's doubled our deficit. Yes, there are other factors to that, but he's a communist. There's no other way to put it. We had that show with Russ, who made that quite clear. The problem we have is if Pravin goes, then ostensibly we're going to get Brian Molefe.
Yeah, he's more of a capitalist, so I approve of him.
Well, he's more of a capitalist who, it would seem, will end up siphoning even more money off to the Guptas. So that's just cronyism.
That's really the most important issue here. No, the most important issue is the state capture of the commies, man. The commies, there's too many commies in power. Thankfully, they're sort of angry because India Monopoly Capital is taking over. I would have to say that.
India Monopoly Capital. Yeah. I think Gupta Monopoly Capital would be the more politically correct term. But screw it, we're not politically correct.
Listen, the Rupert and Oppenheimer are two people.
Two white people, but they represent every white person. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
By the way,
They've funded my roles. Did they not fund yours?
But are you going to their farm this weekend or next one? I'm going to the Oppenheimers this weekend. Are you going to the Rupert's?
Yeah, I'll have to go to the Rupert's then. Oh. I mean, there is enough space in the 47-bedroom
palace.
It's
the lottery, right? For every white person in South Africa, it's the lottery.
Yeah, but why are you telling the secret white stuff on the podcast?
It's a secret handshake and everything.
I mean, seriously, Ramon, you can't, like, we've kept the privilege inside you for so long, and now you're just, like, letting it out.
Maybe. No one listens to us anyway. We're just some rabid racist on the internet talking nonsense. I'm just talking about censorship. Hate speech bill.
Oof.
How's that for a fuck up?
Yeah, so that's something that's come up. We probably should at some point have maybe Martin van Staden back on.
No way. Well, yes, Martin would be
no
good.
Way?
No, not no way.
Yeah, that, Martin. No way you're coming back on the show.
No, Mark Oppenheimer, I think it would be, well, both of them, fuck it. This is a free show. We don't need this bullshit of one at a time. There's no gatekeepers here.
They can fight it out in the waiting area and whoever survives can come
on. So the hate speech bill is probably the most pernicious and disgusting piece of legislation I've ever seen post 94. Okay, maybe not the most, but it's definitely on track to totalitarianism.
Yeah, that state information bill, and then the protection of state information, and then this, I think, are the two.
That makes far more sense than hate speech bill. This hate speech bill is like just pure propaganda. Basically, if you call a politician corrupt,
well, everything we've done on the show for the last 40 minutes would be illegal. We would both be going to prison for several terms.
Well, it's 3 years.
Over.
It's 3 years. And then if you're found guilty again, I think it's 10 years.
Well, we'd just be put away forever.
Right. And then I'll go on a hunger strike.
Because you did call a minister potentially alcoholic.
She's not fucking potential. She is a fucking alcoholic.
I tried to give you an out.
It's not potential.
I tried.
It's not potential. There's a great tweet that says only Grant's Butterbeer that Lamini cares about. And it's a bottle of Grant's whiskey.
You know, as a French Arab, why are we speaking English? Why are you speaking the master's language, Ramon? I think we should be speaking French on this show.
Because I'm undermining the white people from within by appropriating their culture.
That's true.
That's how it works.
I don't have an answer for that.
Right, as a Jew, you should be speaking whatever you speak, Yiddish. No.
That's true.
Hebrew.
Yeah, well, Yiddish is sort of a dead language. Lovely language, though. But, well, yes, Israelis speak Hebrew. But yes, not all Jews.
Zionists.
Hashtag not all Jews.
Hashtag not all Jews. By the way, we did have Benji Shulman, who is an outright Zionist, on our show. And he says, Israel's great. And what else? Yes, ISIS is around the corner from Israel.
Yeah, he held back a little bit, actually. I thought he was very reasonable and very fair. We did start getting followed after that show by a lot of people who get angry about T-shirts at Virgin Active.
BDSMAH.
Yes.
HPV.
Bondage, sadomasochism, and Leave the Palestinians Alone organization. But he was quite reasonable in saying that, look, Israel is not perfect, doesn't do everything right, does make errors and mistakes, and there are problems. There are certainly problems there.
That's a fundamental difference between the left and the right, I would argue. Well, it's not my argument, I've heard it somewhere else. The left believes in perfectibility of humanity. The right does not.
Yes, and there's also a better approach to finding problems internally and trying to resolve them, I think. You've got a lot of – we've had a lot on our show whereby – and look, we've tried to get people from both sides. We make no bones about where our biases lie. I think we're pretty reasonable about that. But – We've had issues getting people on. We blocked on Twitter by I don't know how many people
For asking a question.
For asking, will you come on our show? I'm actually
glad we're being blocked by social justice warriors, because I don't think they'll exist for much longer in the current form. I think they've lost a lot of credibility.
They're not introspective. So the problem is that what I've seen with a lot of our guests, certainly who fall more to center or even right, and it's funny because I think 20 years ago, if you were far left, you're now pretty much right.
Yeah.
But what I've seen by a lot of them is that they are self-critical, and they will not tell you that their approach is necessarily perfect. They will tell you, yes, there are problems, but they believe this is the right way or this is the right thing to do. It's very difficult to get a similar thing from the left, although we did have who was the gent on that we had a couple of weeks back?
Byron McFadden.
Yes, Byron. Sorry. Sorry, Byron. You know, Byron, I thought was quite reasonable about it in being able to say, look, he buys into Marxism, but he does see that it can be perverted. In my opinion, it's always perverted, but in his opinion,
it's a perversion.
In his opinion, it can be perverted, and yes, there are problems. So that's nice and that's how you find middle ground, I think.
Right. I mean, you want to speak to the people who have a problem with the people who share the ideology. Like, I dislike libertarians, generally speaking, and capitalists, right?
That's why Martin can't come back. Why do you dislike libertarians?
Oh, no, there's a massive blind spot, right? I think they fail to understand that culture is a vitally important component of how people act. And the fact that if you just whittle away the state and give people ultimate freedom,
yeah,
that's a panacea.
So I think, you know, I've probably got a lot of libertarian leanings, but I think open borders, for example, is an area where, you know, true libertarians would say, I am completely not libertarian at all, can't call myself anything of the sort.
Well, I'm for closed borders if that border is privatized. I think there's a not a duty, but there should be an obligation to help people when possible. And I think the lottery of life is if you are born in a shitty area, I don't think you should be confined to that area. So I mean, it's more, far more of a metaphysical argument than a political or pragmatic one for me.
Okay, all right. Well,
that's just me.
There you go, libertarians. So
in your face,
the anarchist isn't sure about you. He isn't sure about. Don't worry, he's crazy. He's completely nuts.
But I do think people. But back to my original point. But people who do question their own ideology are often the most interesting people to have around. Of course, we had Aragorn Eloff, the very strong anarcho-communist, who I felt refused to budge on very important issues.
Well, as one of our Twitter followers said, it was like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall.
Right.
It was very difficult.
And he's friends with me on Facebook, and I quite like him as a person, but he doesn't see the blind spots within his own ideology. And in the last year, I think, has been seeing the blind spots in mine, in my ideology. So now I'm actually not a libertarian or any particular political...
Well, you're still an anarchist. You still want everything to fall.
No, but not in the sense that... that... only in the sense that it's holding us back.
The state is holding us back.
Yeah, the state and all the distortions.
I think we might have made a major breakthrough here. You know, what have we done? Over 50 hours of therapy sessions with Ramon. And because that's what the Renegade Report really is. So if the state really just left you the hell alone to get on with it, you would kind of be okay with that? Like...
For me personally,
yeah.
Yes, but because I'm an enlightened person, I read a lot, I'm curious about the world. Other people are not curious about the world. And maybe I need the state to protect me from them.
I think that's quite a shift in some respect.
No, I mean, I've always been a pragmatic anarchist.
That's an interesting word. Some people hate the word pragmatic.
Libertarians. I hate the word pragmatic. So Martin Watson, who was our second or third guest, I think.
Martin, you're getting a lot of airtime today.
Yeah, you are getting a lot of airtime. So he joined the Free Market Foundation recently, and he had a post about Herbert Mashaba not being a libertarian because he's not actually privatizing anything.
Yeah, and I've repeatedly said to him, look, dude, the guy is sitting in a government that is basically a left-wing, socialist, borderline communist government. Like... to expect him overnight to sort of just free everything up and make it all libertarian.
Well, but he doesn't have the mandate to privatize things, first and foremost. He's there to run a city.
Mm. But it's also not pragmatically reasonable.
Well, if he wants to last in his position,
yeah,
you give concessions for the first term.
Mm.
If you do well, you win possibly full power in 5 years' time. When he's mayor with a majority in council, then he can do his vanity project.
And I think, although they've gone the wrong way, but I think the DA has shown that in the Cape. They did a little bit by a little bit, and slowly as they became more powerful and more popular, I guess, as the party to vote for, they've implemented more and more of their policies, some of which are absolutely, well, ridiculous, like the alcohol sort of ban.
Okay, I'm not worried about the minutia, so to speak, but more importantly, the concept is, or my broader point, is that ideology is good to some degree, but it won't solve many issues, especially if you look in context. So if you say, yes, Pravda does everything, cool. If Herman does do that, he'll be out tomorrow.
Yeah, well, he won't even get there. I mean, exactly. You know, he came in, and I think the one example is, and the one that many people were upset about, was he wanted to privatize the waste people, pick it up. And he basically mentioned it in his first 2 weeks in office. He hadn't actually done anything yet. He mentioned the possibility, and everyone went nuts. And I think he had to quickly realize that, unfortunately, as you say, if he wants to stay in his position, there's a way. And I've always said it, you know, it's about de-escalation. So, yes, I do think that the state is too big and they have too much power, but I'm also realistic in that it's not going to disappear overnight unless, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, 17 million people say this government hasn't given us our basically food, money to buy food for the month. We're done with them, and we get an overthrow, some sort of coup.
Is that a bad thing? No, it is.
Yeah.
Every violent revolution is a bad thing.
So we would argue that all violence is bad. Let's assume there's no violence. No one dies, right? Let's assume there's no violence.
Not even a politician?
Not even
a
politician.
You call yourself a revolutionary if you don't kill a politician.
It's not normally the politicians that suffer the worst. It's usually just civilians. But I think, you know, for that to happen, would it be bad even if there was no violence? Well, probably in the short term. In the long term, maybe not. I don't know. It's an interesting thought experiment. I'm not sure. I think it would be very interesting in a country that has had no major political change in 22 years and has,
some would argue, 60 years.
Fair enough. We had one. You could argue, I mean, don't think you can argue that 94 wasn't a big change, but it certainly, in ideology, it wasn't the biggest change.
Let's just say the policies have carried on.
Exactly. I mean, we know this. They haven't even replaced most of the apartheid laws. They still, you know, the one government just took over from the other government and carried on with it. I think we are due for something. A lot of people would probably hope for
an upgrade,
a democratic change, but at some point something's going to give. And I think, you know, if you push the poor, and Moletti and Becky spoke about it, you know, that 11 million people who are, you know, the data we have is actually, we've got a burgeoning middle class. They are growing. Certainly, the black middle class is growing quite rapidly. The monopoly capital is still, there still are a lot of wealthy white people, but the number of black people with wealth is now equaling or eclipsing that.
Yep.
Certainly, in the public sector, black capital eclipses white capital, so to speak.
Well, and in the private sector.
I think it was equaling if at the time when we chatted to him.
The black middle class is bigger than the white middle class.
Yeah, and the upper class, though, is still about equal, I think, or the white middle class is still a little, white upper class is still slightly bigger. But the point is that it's an interesting dynamic because we've got this split, and what he pointed to was that 11 million people, those are the people kind of, you could argue, are left behind.
Right, and those are placated with grants and shit like that, and no one actually respects them. I would argue they're used as pawns for the ANC when it needs them. It's used by the DA in Parliament when it needs them, but no one's actually saying why are these people still poor. But then again, those people add 20% to the average electoral vote of the ANC. So maybe fuck them then. Who knows?
20%? I don't know, more, because, you know, not that many people actually vote, as you repeatedly pointed out.
Right. But, I mean, sooner or later, we have to hold the average ANC voter as accomplices to what's happening. It's starting to come out. Tim Modise, who's quite a well-known broadcaster, has a tweet about George Bernard Shaw, and if you keep quiet and if you actually vote for someone who doesn't have to be bad, you're an accomplice.
Mm.
So it's starting to come out that, you know, the ANC is not acting because it's acting. It has a mandate and was voted in by a popular vote. We're never going to hold those voters accountable for what's happening.
Well, they might end up holding themselves accountable inadvertently. We don't have too much more time. We don't want to chew your ear off too much, but you wanted to just talk about objectivity and subjectivity, I think,
it's more of a mindset of the world. So we had Ali Shakur on last week. Yes, the Hotep movement, right? And he spoke about the perception of how you see yourself within the world, and you see problems through a subjective lens or an objective lens. So, and he just gave an example, you know, of someone who was angry at something.
Yeah, let's give that a listen.
Well, we look at things objectively, and they look at things subjectively. That's the bottom line. If you ask me what I think of all this mess, I'd say it'd be inevitable. You take a sample from a random pond and throw it in a petri dish and watch that thing change over time. You're going to see things devour each other. You're going to see things help nourish each other, right?
Yeah.
We're just organisms in a petri dish, us humans. So there's going to be conflict. The question is, when does the consciousness rise high enough so that we don't act like puny organisms? You see what I'm saying? So my thing is, if you're in the know and you call yourself conscious or so-called woke, you would start looking at things objectively, right? And say, well, if I know all of this, well, here's my biggest gripe with these people on the left. They say we have black girl magic, we have melanin power, melanin, and all this, you know, he was Kangs. And it's like, so if you're so great, why are you complaining? If you're so great, why do you allow the people you call racist to control the territory you live in? It is fully within your capabilities to remove them. And I don't mean to do this violently. If you are so great, you'd be able to tactfully and politically remove them from your region. But you can't. Why? Because you're distracted by the nonsense that happens in the media that enrages you. So instead of you building up your community on Saturdays, guess what you're doing? You're marching in the streets, wasting time, dirtying up somebody else's community. Not only that, you're bringing economic profitability to these regions when you show up by the thousands. And these shops that you shop at, they're not black owned. So you're just giving money back to somebody else and not your community. It is recycled trash over and over again.
Yeah, and that was, I think, one of the most sort of outspoken guests we've had on the show.
Yeah, someone with no real filter on, which is required. I mean, as always, I agree with most of what he says. I do apply the principle he espouses for the black community. I can espouse them for everyone, you know, in the world, about self-determination and self-enrichment and controlling your mindset and things like that. I think those are all very good principles to follow anyway.
Yeah, good principles. I didn't buy into the collective argument that he was proposing, but that's okay. I don't have to. So, look, it's been a great year. We've had some great shows, and we really have, as much as we are very proud and loud about our place as a podcast. We're surprised, I think. I am, certainly.
Oh, so now you're surprised. Play back the podcast from the beginning. Are you not surprised?
So certainly I think I'm surprised by the level of engagement we've received, and the success that we've had this far. We want to obviously continue going with that.
But we want to exceed that as well.
Yeah. So look, if you listen to the first shows, you'll hear we are a lot better at using these microphones now, I think, than we were in the beginning. I make a lot less screw-ups on this soundboard than I used to. We really would like your input on the show. So if the things you don't like, it's great when you tell us the things you do like, but it's nice to hear when you don't like things too, so we can try and correct them. Or we can also give some thought to the opinion and comment we're giving or the guests we're getting. We want you to recommend guests that you'd like on the show. Please, not someone who was on Ruben Report last week. Obviously, guys, it is very difficult to get a lot of these international guests. If they were on Ruben last week, the chances are zero.
Right, and but don't forget, Ruben has a team of like 10 or 15 people, right, who do the research, who book the guests. We just two, like,
yeah,
business.
Doing this in our part-time.
I run my own business. Jonathan is a doctor. I mean, we're doing this for free in our spare time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, getting, yeah, doing the work of quite a few people.
Yeah.
And we like it. Don't get us wrong. But it doesn't come that easily just to get whoever we want when we want.
Yeah. So this brings me to another point. If you like the show, so far you've downloaded a year worth of shows for free, and that will not change. The show will always be free. However, it would be great if you would be interested in funding the show. If you own a business, if you want to sponsor at some point, Cliff Central has some great packages and things. We say this because it will allow us to do certain things and expand a right. little bit. Obviously, you know, you can do some cool things with money.
Right, and it's just a question of, for example, if we have a guest in Cape Town, instead of just doing a Skype session, we can actually just fly him up for a day and speak to them in person, for example. Yeah. Sooner or later, we want to expand a bit more than a podcast, maybe have a Renegade Report gathering of sorts, invite a few guests on, have a venue, have an open speaker policy, deplatform SJWs. not really, but maybe have some sort of not a conference, because that sounds terrible, but like talks.
Yeah, get together and
open to the public.
And obviously we'd like to do that, but as Ramon says, two guys on our own kind of producing the show. So if you want to get involved at any level, let us know. You can always contact us. Our email address for the show is renegadereportmailbox@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter @renegade_reports. On Facebook. You want to talk the Facebook group a little bit?
Right. So we have a discussion group on Facebook, anyone can join. It's a private group, so everyone's vetted before coming in, of course. Unfortunately, we had to block one person. And we just talk about ideas and topics and guests on the show. But so join us. That link, we link that quite often on Twitter and on our Facebook page too. But nevertheless, I mean, back to the funding scenario. So if you are keen to fund us, you can fund us for one show. You can fund us for a month's worth of shows. We're very flexible. PayPal, US dollars, not Zimbabwean dollars, unfortunately.
All right.
Maybe not even rands. So the show will always carry on, but we have other ideas. We just don't have the time or capacity or funding or anything to go with them. So if you like us, pop us a mail. Let's do something together.
Yeah, that'll be great.
If you just like listening to the show, that's all we actually care about.
Cool.
As long as you enjoy what we hear.
If you're just a listener to the show, then you can obviously rate us. If you're listening through iTunes, please rate us. We do appreciate that. It also ups our rating or puts us on people's screens in iTunes, at least, so that we get more listeners, hopefully. You can always communicate with us on Twitter. I'm sure by now you know the handles. And we will catch you next time. Thanks so much for listening for the past year. CliffCentral.com.